What's up, everybody? This is your host, SB Sanchez, and we are back for yet another episode and another chance to get mentally entangled with somebody new. Before we start, I do have to share a few educational tidbits with you guys so that you guys can kind of understand the topic that will be at hand today. So if you have some paper and a pen, you might want to take it out and take some notes. Today, we're going to be talking about substance use disorder, and I want to give you the definition for that, but in order to do that, I do need to let you guys know what the DSM is, and that is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is basically a manual that is used to investigate, diagnose, and treat mental health disorders, including addiction, which is kind of what we will be discussing today. So a substance use disorder, according to the DSM-5 definition, which is the newest edition, involves patterns of symptoms caused by using a substance that an individual continues taking despite its negative effects. It can include things like trying to cut down or stop using the substance, but not being able to. You can also experience really intense cravings or urges to use the substance. There is a need for you to consume more of the substance in order to get the effect that you're looking for, which is called building a tolerance. And there's a handful of other symptoms too that are listed under that definition. So if you're ever interested on what those symptoms may be, you can go ahead and actually look it up online and make sure to look up the DSM-5 criteria for what a substance use disorder would be, and it'll pop up for you. Now, I felt that the best way to talk about this topic, because it is one that, although it can be common in a lot of people's lives, it is something that's a little bit difficult to talk about. I felt like bringing somebody on that can speak directly from their personal experience with addiction was the best way to go about this. I do consider this person to be a guru in multiple areas. She is somebody that I actually had the opportunity to go to school with and is now involved in the mental health field as well. She just graduated with her master's, so congratulate her when you get the chance. But without further ado, I want to welcome to the Mentally Entangled podcast, Erin. Say hi to everybody.
Hi, everyone.
We are so excited to have you on today. Thank you for hopping on with me. And kind of before we get rolling, I do want to give you the chance to just tell your story. Let us know who you are, some of the things that you've been through, and what you're up to today.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on. It truly is a delight to get to spend this time with you and have this conversation for your listeners. SB was a rock star in school, and I really enjoyed spending time with you and learning about becoming a counselor and just getting to connect on a personal level. And I'm honored to get to share a bit of my story today. So first of all, to your point, addiction is often shrouded in secrecy and shame, mm-hmm. and I believe it's our secrets that keep us sick. So it's really important for me to talk about my story. I'm but one person. This is just my story. I don't speak for any group or organization.
Right.
But it is really important for me to share my experience because many women shared their experiences with me and showed me a way out.
Yeah.
So I am a 48-year-old woman who lives in Birmingham, Alabama. I am a mom of a newly minted college student, which is very interesting. I'm a wife, I'm a daughter, an aunt, and a friend. And I am a person in long-term recovery. I have been sober for 8 years. And that my primary drug of choice was alcohol, though I also consider myself to be an addiction from other things, and we can talk more about that. I'll say in general, I really believe that for me, addiction is a kind of a big umbrella.
Yeah.
So while alcohol was the thing that got me into recovery, you know, there were many other pieces of my life that I needed to examine, many other addictive behaviors. Yeah. So I consider myself being in recovery from alcohol, from workaholism, from codependency, and some other things. Just really briefly, I am a writer. That's a really important part of my identity. And before I became a counselor, I spent over 20 years working as a professional writer and communicator. Mm-hmm. And that's also something I continue to do as a person working in the mental health field. So words really, really matter to me.
Yeah.
And giving voice to stories matter. So I salute you for what you're doing, as you talk with people about their personal experiences.
Well, thank you. And again, seriously, I think some of the stuff that we're going to be talking about today, you are going to bless so many people's lives just knowing that they are listening to somebody that is just so real and has been through it and done the things, and you've survived it too. I think that's something that people look for, right? Finding somebody that they can speak to who has made it through some of the bumps that they might be in the middle of trying to overcome as well. I did want to ask you the first question before we get into a million other questions that I definitely have for you today. And again, you know, this is a question that I ask everybody as they come on. I know you're a counselor as well, so I imagine I'll probably hear a little bit of that within your answer. But what does mental health mean to you?
Such a good question. You know, in recent years, the phrase mental health is health has become really popular. And I agree with that. It's sort of a big answer, but I see mental health as this whole person, mind, body, connection. Mm-hmm. You know, how is someone doing emotionally, spiritually, physically? How are they feeling? How are they connecting with the world? How are they feeling about themselves? But I very much see it as a whole person, not just a brain. I don't believe we're just brains floating around.
Right.
You know, I believe mental health is a really complicated set of connections within our body and soul, mm-hmm. and heart. Yeah. And in some ways, the gauges of mental health for me are, it's about how am I feeling today, and how am I managing, and how am I connecting with others?
Yeah. I like the way that you worded how you're feeling today, because also that can change. How you're feeling today may not be how you feel tomorrow. How you feel tomorrow may not be how you feel next year. And understanding that, like, our mental health is kind of like a roller coaster. It's up, down, sideways, left, right, which is why it's so important for us to stay in touch with it as well.
Yeah,
I think
that's
something that we don't understand. It's not one of those things we can just like, oh, I'm mentally healthy, done. And it's like just off the checklist. It has to be something that we have to come back to, which also makes it difficult to be aware of sometimes, because life is crazy.
It is crazy. And, you know, and it changes within the seasons of our lives. So mm-hmm. I mentioned having a newly minted college student. So the mental health things that are impacting me today are very different than when I had a toddler.
Exactly.
They're very different than when I worked a corporate job. They're very different than when I was a counseling student. Though there are certainly patterns, and that's what I think is fascinating, you know, as we mm-hmm. start to engage with conversations around mental health, being able to really get the tools to think about what are the patterns in my life that I see over time, regardless of the circumstances.
Absolutely.
And how can I engage with that?
Yeah. And realizing, honestly, mental health is kind of like getting to know yourself continuously, though, not just when you're little, not just when you're a teenager, but like continuously taking a step back and being like, okay, what works for me? What doesn't? What makes me tick? What upsets me? What makes me sad? What triggers me? But you have to continuously do those check-ins in order to kind of know even where to start with some of those things.
Absolutely. So. And also surround yourself with people who can help at different mm-hmm. points. And those kinds of helpers and friends and support partners may look different at different points of life. So, you know, who are the people that you're choosing to surround yourself with, be they friends or professionals?
Yes, yes. I like to refer to my support system as roots. Because, like, you know, when you plant something, the roots don't just go like straight down in one line. They kind of mm-hmm. like branch out and go everywhere. And so my support system keeps me grounded, right? But at the same time too, not all my roots go in the same direction. So I have like my mom, but I know that if I tell her I'm not feeling pretty today, that she's going to be biased and she's going to be like, you're the most gorgeous thing in the world. But sometimes I need something different. So then I might have like my friend over here who's just really blunt and honest that I might need to talk to sometimes as well. So I like that idea of having a support system, an environment around you that can kind of help you be aware of some of those nicks and knacks as you grow up and mature as well. So,
exactly.
But thank you. That's a great definition. I really like that. To go back to your story, there's, again, so many questions I want to ask you. I guess my first question for you is, when did you decide to take this journey towards recovery? Was there a singular moment that kind of that was it, and that made you decide to go for it? Was there an evolution of moments? Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think it was an evolution. Mm-hmm. So to set the scene for you a little bit, I had a feeling I may have had a problem with alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little knock on the door to my heart.
Right.
And in my 30s, as I was growing, I had a young child and a great career, and I was super busy.
Yeah.
I noticed over time that I was turning to alcohol, maybe more than I should have.
Okay.
And for me, I did look at a lot of messages to try to justify that my drinking was quote unquote normal.
Yeah.
And I'd say to myself, well, I haven't had consequences. You know, I have this, this great job. I was working as a magazine editor at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I have this great family. It doesn't look bad. And that, I learned later that's pretty common.
Yeah.
it doesn't necessarily get bad right away.
Yeah.
Alcohol does a great job, at first of taking away, some anxiety. The problem, and I've always had anxiety. The problem is it also fuels anxiety. I'd come home from a long day at the office and, you know, I'd say to myself, oh, I deserve that glass of wine. And that glass became two or three.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, I didn't like the way that I felt. I didn't like the fact that I was relying on this substance. I didn't like waking up with hangovers. And then eventually, I did not like my behaviors.
Yeah.
My behaviors were not in line with who I really was.
Yeah.
And I was really, really troubled with some of the ways that I acted and ways that I was living in secrecy and shame.
Okay.
Yeah.
How long was that period between when you noticed that maybe there was something a little bit more going on and when you were actually successfully able to start your journey?
Years.
Yeah.
The entirety of my 30s, I would say, really was the period. So I had kind of experimented with alcohol
mm-hmm.
earlier in life, but it was really during, I had my son at 30.
Mm-hmm.
It was really after I had him and started having these, anxieties about being a mom and could I do all the things? But I did a lot of what we call research, basically between age 30 and 39, which is when I got sober. By the time I got into my later 30s, I was having consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And they were consequences that were visible to others, not just to me.
Yeah.
So I had been doing the research. And then finally in 2015, I would say I experienced my own bottom, but I should also say my bottom looked like, and again, this is how I justify things.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't lost my job.
Right.
I hadn't destroyed a marriage,
yeah.
But there were certainly impacts
of course.
Within each.
Yeah.
So I do remember one day getting home and my husband saying, enough. This is enough. And I had been doing some research into modes of recovery, and I can speak to that. But that was in the fall of 2015 is when I, in earnest, said, okay, I really have a problem here and I need help.
Yeah. The reason why I kind of wanted you to break that down, and I thank you for being truthful, first of all, is it's not just something that you wake up and can change 0 to 100. These are things that happen over a period of time. And like you said, there was a lot of life happening, right, in between you being a mom and doing all these things and having this career and being a wife. Like, there's so many moving parts that it's not always easy to, like, just take this one section and go 0 to 100. And people need to understand that it's a process. It's a journey. And, like, you use the term long term.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. It's not a one-time decision. Again, it's not just a box that you get to check off either.
That's right. And we'll get into this, I'm sure. But, yes, I got sober from alcohol, but that was just the start.
Right.
This, I believe, is a lifelong process of recovery. And I was fortunate, blessed. I consider myself blessed to have started, but it would be a process that I would continue, hopefully, God willing, for the rest of my life. But there was, we talk as mental health professionals about stages of decision making. So mm-hmm. I was in a long period of pre-contemplation. But enough things happened where I had what we in the 12-step fellowship that I'm a part of, I had willingness.
Right.
I had a willingness. And then it was clear that the journey was going to really have to begin.
Yeah. So what was the hardest part?
Oh, that's such a good question. admitting that I had a problem.
Mm-hmm.
A problem in such a way that I couldn't think my way out of it. Mm. I was very good at doing research and, you know, being a fixer, solving problems. That's how I approached most of my life.
Right.
Personally, professionally, I was a capable, intelligent woman and I handled stuff.
Yeah.
At a very high level. And none of that mattered in terms of getting sober from alcohol. I will also say, too, I got sober at the same time from benzodiazepines, benzos for short. So I had been prescribed Xanax by a physician, and that really became very problematic.
Yeah.
And I was getting off of both. And I now know that that actually is a very, very dangerous thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of things I would have done differently, including getting medical help, to be frank. Really saying, I knew once I said I had a problem, I was going to have to get serious.
Yeah.
So definitely saying, you know, I have addiction.
Yeah.
And then asking for help. Just unpack. There was so much shame. I felt it. Now, I now know that it's not a moral failing. Addiction is not a moral failing, but I did not know that at the time. So I was just really seeped in this like failure, the sense of failure.
Yeah. And almost there's this fear of having to then say it out loud and admit that you need help, because then you're in your, from your perspective, you're admitting to that failure.
That's
all you know.
That's all you know. Yeah. And yeah, so it did. It's to say it out loud meant, I was going to say I knew what it meant. I didn't really know what it meant.
Yeah.
I also didn't have framework for what did it mean to get help?
Mm-hmm.
What did it actually look like? I had one family member who had gotten help and was sober, and I did reach out to him and he was helpful, but it was shrouded in mystery.
Mm.
Another thing that I alluded to at the beginning, like I really want to normalize recovery.
Yeah.
you know, that I thought at the time, oh gosh, it just seemed like it was so secretive.
Yeah.
But that's not really true. I just wasn't in this world yet. So yeah, I was scared of what I was going to have to do.
Yeah. I like that you used the word like secretive. There's a lot of effort put into trying to know, not show like little details,
mm-hmm.
or even within family systems.
That's right.
It's like, okay, if, you know, this family member is presenting with these issues, okay, but it stays in the home. But in reality, in order for a person to get the help that they need, they're going to need to build a support system around them that is open-minded and willing to understand it, not just keep it a secret, but let's bring it to the surface. Let's talk about it. Let's understand it so that I then know how to be here for you while you go on your journey that you need to go on.
That's right. Because it is a family. I'll say a family disease. I do operate from the disease. I'll say the disease plus model, but mm-hmm. You know, I do believe, and you mentioned substance use disorder being classified in DSM. So just for shorthand, I will say the whole family is affected.
Yeah.
It helped me when I was doing this research the last few years of my drinking. I would read memoir by women who had gotten sober. I listened to a particular podcast by two women who got sober, and I was hearing a little bit about the conversations that had happened with their family members. Mm-hmm. I was hearing about what it was like to be a mom who, you know, the wine mom trope, and how it wasn't just a joke or something on a Target t-shirt. It was really serious. But just hearing
you, like, said a Target t-shirt. I just got that.
Yeah, you know, like, mommy needs wine.
Like the little memes. And, yeah.
Yeah, which was very popular back then when I was getting sober. And yeah, I just didn't know how to access any of this language at all. So it was really important it's really important for me, again, like to normalize talking about this, to normalize, yeah. Like, yeah, this affects entire families and, mm-hmm. you know, and it's like that with so many other things where, again, like you mentioned, let's just deal with it among the family.
Right.
But again, I just go with like secrets make you sick. And there are so many helpers in this world who are there to help, but you can't get help if you're keeping a secret in your family and not reaching out.
Yeah. And nobody has the ability. You mentioned that you were still very high performing.
Mm-hmm.
You still held a very good job. You were very good at what you do. Still are. And you were still being part of a functional family, right?
Yep.
A wife, mom, and all these things. And so there's not always going to be the opportunity for somebody to look at you and realize what it is that you have going on. So being able to verbalize that is sometimes like, that's exactly what needs to happen.
Exactly.
Or else that, like, you can't even start. You can't start something if it's not initialized, like, hey, this is a thing. And us putting it out there so that we can kind of break it down and then take the next steps that need to be taken.
Absolutely. So. And I would later come to learn, like, I was not the only one who was, quote unquote, you know, high functioning.
Right.
Which I kind of laugh at now. I really wasn't functioning that well, but high performing. You know, the when I got into recovery, I was meeting doctors and lawyers and mm-hmm. other executives. And, you know, Silicon Valley is powered by, you know, people who have a lot of their own addiction things. And,
yeah.
and we can talk more about this, but I really believe there's a very, very deep connection between, you know, with my addiction, it connects to external validation.
Yeah.
I always say external validation is my original drug.
Mm.
So, you know, I am not alone in being somebody who collected gold stars.
Oh,
at
for
being
sure.
The yeah. best professional. And by the way, being the best, you know, person who was using, because we're not taught, and this is no slander on, I have a wonderful family of origin. Came from a wonderful community, but as far as learning healthy coping skills, you know, not growing up in the 80s, there wasn't a lot of conversations around healthy coping and emotional intelligence, and certainly not around my genetic predisposition to alcoholism, which
yeah.
I do have.
Yeah.
But that's a lot of words for me to say. I've come to learn. There are a lot of really smart people who have addiction issues,
and let alone just mental health issues.
Yeah,
period.
That's right.
And
that's right.
That's one thing too. It's like somebody holding a high status in society does not make them untouchable, right? And we have this way of thinking that, like, oh, this person's made it. They couldn't be an alcoholic. No, mm-hmm. never. This is a mom. No, that mom could never. Right. Mm-hmm. But it's like, no, everybody. Everybody can end up in a situation like that, right? And understanding there's no label, there's no age, there's no gender, there's no orientation mm-hmm. that makes you untouchable to these things. So pretending that these things don't exist within certain communities, that just doesn't make sense. Because then it just leaves people with a lack of education. That's all it does.
That's right.
That's all it does.
You're right. It doesn't discriminate. You know, when I look mm-hmm. back now, you know, as somebody who is a counselor and knows a little bit about risk factors.
Exactly.
Like, oh my goodness. Like,
yeah.
How, of course this was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. But I had those, I had all these misconceptions, and I'm ashamed to say, but I thought of the, you know, the person drinking out of a paper sack under the bridge.
Right.
And I meet people to this day who are like, or they'll say, somebody said to me recently, I think they'd heard about my story from somewhere I'd shared it. And they said, I had no idea. And I was
right.
like, well, you wouldn't know.
Exactly.
Now,
I made sure you didn't know.
I made sure. I worked real hard.
Right.
Now that, but people closest to me knew.
Uh-huh.
And
because they felt it.
Yeah, they felt it. And I knew. So when I talk about my bottom and what happened, for me, it was a complete spiritual disconnect.
Mm.
So my bottom, and again, there were consequences, but the worst part of being in active addiction was a complete spiritual disconnect from what I now call God.
Yeah.
And a disconnection from myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the darkest time to really feel there was no hope out of that hole.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very truthful. It's very truthful to sit with.
Yeah. It's a, that was the worst days. I traveled for a living. I was a travel editor, and I would wake up in hotel rooms after having a lot to drink. And I remember being in one hotel room in particular, just so much shame and so much guilt. and searching for some scripture that I had read. And just feeling this just pang of disconnection.
Yeah.
Like there was no way out. And I will say, the way that I got out was someone who had gone through this experience, who were actually many someones.
Yeah.
Who said, there is a way out.
Right.
And this is how I did it. This is how you can do it. You are not alone. So for me, that face of God, you know, comes through other people who say there's hope. And that's also true for anything. I, you know, that's where I see, you know, I see God in people who reach out to folks who are really struggling, which is a whole other, it's a whole other side note, but spirituality is a really important part of my recovery.
Yeah.
I'm just really thankful for those people who came to my rescue and my aid and said, hey, there's a whole other way.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate you sharing that. And I appreciate you talking about like that disconnect that you felt. Now, you know, everybody's going to have different spiritual backgrounds and that's okay. There's no right or wrong way to do it. But for you, that was it. That was the quote unquote right way for you to do it. And I like how you use the word disconnect because it kind of shows, I read this somewhere and I wish I can remember where I read it, but it was talking about how an addict is not just a consumer of whatever substance that they are battling with, but they are also the receiver of consumption, which is basically their entire life just starts to just get sucked, just all the life out of everything else until there's just this one thing, you know? And so you experiencing that disconnect, it goes to show something that you used to be really grounded with now almost could not exist as much for you, right? What are some other areas that you felt that disconnect? Like, I imagine that there was probably struggles within your marriage.
Sure.
And even your ability to be a mom during that time. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I wasn't great at telling the truth.
Mm.
And again, it is classic addict or alcoholic. I'll use that term for myself. Behavior. Because I was lying to myself all the time. So if you're lying to yourself, it's really hard to connect with a partner.
Yeah.
You know, and I built up sort of this, and again, justified, you know, my existence. So, you know, it certainly impacted my marriage. And I think how I showed up as a mom, I think it impacted how I showed up as a friend. I think it just impacted the kinds of relationships that I engage with in my life, you know.
Do you feel that you became like more isolated during this time?
Yeah.
More alone?
Oh, yeah. All I did was, again, identifying as a workaholic. I worked and I was working in a industry that was falling apart. Media in 2008 to 2015 was not pretty, like a lot of industries then and now. And there was always a pressure to do more and produce more and to not be the one that got laid off. I was in an environment where layoffs were constant, as they are now in many places. Yeah. Not unique, but yeah, I worked and came home and saw my son, my family, and drank and did all over again.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wasn't cultivating great outside relationships, friends or hobbies or interests. My world did get smaller and smaller. There was a lot of isolating, you know, and I mentioned drinking when I was on the road, and I did have access in a way that, you know, put me in that path, but also I drank when I was at home. I'd sit at the dining room table.
Yeah.
You know, today in my life, I'm, you know, interested in taking dance classes and, you know, art classes. I was not thinking about that when I was in active addiction. I was sitting at my dining room table drinking at how the world had done me wrong. And,
right.
you know, yeah. I was the victim. Right. And if you had this life, I had a great life. But everything was very cloudy and circular.
It becomes difficult to see even the simplest joys that maybe somebody would experience. Those lose meaning.
Yeah.
I think.
Absolutely. I mean, even, the simple, enjoying a cup of coffee. I mean, in the morning now I get up and, you know, we have this whole coffee routine in the morning and I do my like, prayer meditation and I read. We have our iPads. That's not what life looked like back then. I mean, it wasn't about savoring coffee or, you know, going on a walk. And again, I'm not saying I'm some like spiritual giant, like, you know, but I can enjoy simple pleasures. And recovery is about, to me, being present. I was never present. Like, another thing I'll say to that, like, I was always very interested in meditation, Buddhism. I'm Catholic, but I believe there are many, many paths. And I've got a lot of paths on my journey. But, you know, I could never do a sitting meditation. My brain was just constant chaos.
Yeah.
So it's like these things that I have even a fighting chance to do.
Yeah.
But it took a number of years. I mean, again, like you mentioned earlier, it wasn't a flipping the switch.
Yeah.
I was in the first couple of years, I believe I had what's not talked about a lot in, I think, late circles, but post-alcohol withdrawal syndrome. I mean, I think for quite some time. So it took me a while to get that out of my system and then to start doing the emotional work of recovery, which is really the actual, like, that's the actual work.
Yeah.
Like stopping the substance is like, is but a start.
Yeah.
Then the real work happens.
Yeah. Yeah. Darn it. I was just going to ask you something. Oh, meditation. Have you mastered that?
Oh.
Because I can't do it. Woman, I cannot do it. I'm telling you, like, I don't know what's going on. I've tried. And I'll even do, okay, so I tried this because I got recommended. You know the YouTube ones where it'll just like, it'll be just like a sound, like in the background. I have sat on the couch and been like, I'm going to meditate. And I don't know if it's because I'm trying too hard to stay calm, but it'll be like 60 seconds in. And then I'll realize I'm thinking about something. Like I'll start by thinking about trying not to think, and then I'll find myself thinking about something. I can't do it.
You're doing a good job. Hey, if you're trying, if I told you I'd mastered meditation, then I think you should say, get on out of here. Because, I try.
Yeah.
And, you know, they say it's a practice for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, true. I try and it's
do it
really,
over and over.
Yeah. And like trying different kinds, but no, I've not come anywhere near close to mastering.
Yeah. That was more of a question just for myself. Yeah. But, back on topic, I wanted to ask, so you've obviously been through the thing, right? And you're still doing it and you practice continuing to stay sober as well, even today. But what's something that you would tell a person who's attempting? Let's say they're kind of in that, in one of your other podcast interviews that you've been on, because I did take a listen to some of those. You said, what did you say? You said, you used the word curious. What was the term you used?
Sober curious.
Sober curious. Thank you. Use the word sober curious. So somebody that's kind of in that kind of back and forth that you were explaining that you were in for a little bit, what would you tell somebody?
Yes. Well, first of all, it's much more of a thing now to be sober curious. There are a lot more resources these days for folks who are sober curious. It's actually become kind of trendy. Mm-hmm. It's kind of great. You know, I think people can examine their relationship with alcohol for a lot of reasons. You don't need to be addicted to that substance to examine it. And it's always good. I think one of the big questions to ask is, you know, am I getting more? What am I getting out of drinking or whatever the substance is?
Yeah.
Am I getting more or am I losing more? And just asking yourself really honestly, like, what am I getting from this? What is it taking?
Like almost making like a positive and negative list.
Yeah. You know, and examining if it's coming up, if you're getting curious, there is a reason for that curiosity. So I would encourage folks to acknowledge that reason. Does it mean, you know, are you curious because you've woken up with too many hangovers that you don't like? Is it because you haven't liked how you've acted when you've been under the influence? Is it because you have a family history or you've seen other people be impacted by this? Is it because you're health conscious? You know, that's the other kind of really cool thing that I've seen happen in the past years are people who are, and we have data on this, you know, more people are choosing to not drink for health reasons, including younger people.
Yes.
So, thankfully. You know, thankfully, yeah, yes. Like it's not, it's, you know, so that is really exciting. And I think the biggest question is like, what is your motivation for using the substance? Like, are you trying to run for something?
Or cover something
or up.
Or manage something. You mentioned your anxiety.
That's right. So yeah, manage it. It was an easy, quote unquote, easy out. Mm-hmm. So do you find yourself reaching for that glass instead of taking a walk or calling a friend? Mm-hmm. You know, what is it? What does it do for you?
Yeah.
You know, all of these questions about like it are good to ask as far as exploration. Now, if you know in your heart that it's problematic, I think it's it can become very obvious. Like I used to take quizzes. Like I'd Google and take quizzes. Like, am I an alcoholic? Like, if you're Googling that, I have an answer for you.
Right.
and there is help. But I guess my biggest thing is like in the course of all of this discernment, I really want people to know like there are many paths to exploring life with maybe it's harm reduction, meaning you're drinking or using less. Maybe that's mm-hmm. appropriate. Maybe it's going 30 days or going a mm-hmm. year. I have friends that have, you know, taken breaks and gone, hey, this actually really like works for me. I, you know, and also my friends are of an age where alcohol doesn't work really great with our systems general.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, I think just getting really curious about it and then like wherever you fall on this spectrum, knowing there are a lot of like-minded people mm-hmm. who are there to support you.
Yes. That actually leads me to my next question. AA, that kind of is the one, right? The one that people know about. They know about the steps. But most people don't know that there are literally a million other ways to go about this. So other than, well, actually just start from the ground up. What are some of the resources that you used in your journey to kind of get you to where you are today?
Mm-hmm. That is a great question. I will say I am a member of a 12-step fellowship, mm-hmm. First and foremost, and a big believer in that. And in other things. I mentioned that I read a lot of books by women mm-hmm. who had gotten sober.
Yeah.
One resource. So if you even, again, if you Google, you know, paths to sobriety, you know, I think about my friend Laura McCowan. She's an author, has a couple great books, and she was the one who had a podcast that I listened to when mm-hmm. I was getting sober. She has a great group called The Luckiest Club, where they have online meetings that are not 12-step oriented.
Yeah.
And she's got a lot of resources through that and through her writing. And she's a phenomenal source. I think of groups like Smart Recovery. There are Smart Recovery groups all over the country, all over the world. There's mm-hmm. Women for Recovery. There's a group called She Recovers, which is international, and they are phenomenal. They have so many excellent resources. And they say we're all recovering from something. Mm-hmm. And they're just lovely. A lot of the resources I mention are geared towards women because I'm a woman. Yes. But, you know, there are, I believe, just as many for guys. Another one that comes to mind is a newsletter and set of free meetings called The Small Bow. If you just Google Small Bow, they have free meetings for people who are curious. And the writer, AJ, who's behind it, has an excellent newsletter where he shares really, he is a former journalist, and shares great stories of people who are on this journey and in recovery from all kinds of things, not just alcohol.
Yeah.
So those are like just a couple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the list can go on forever. That was my point. Yeah. The list goes on forever. Yeah. And I wish I could remember now. We did a homework assignment and there was one really cool one that I can't remember. But when you like logged onto the website, it was like a wolf in the background. Oh, and it was specifically like highlighted the idea of it not being any sort of, there not being like a religious background to it. Because I know that scares a lot of people away.
Yeah.
Because AA is usually the only one people know about, people are aware that usually that program involves like some sort of come to God type of scenario. And to some people, obviously, that's, you know, I'm really close to my faith. So like that would probably be a route that I would be comfortable with. But for somebody who isn't, that shouldn't be the reason why they stray away from it or are afraid to, like, there will be a program, there will be a group, there will be a therapist, there will be somebody somehow, some way out there who can help you with whatever it is that you're going through.
That's right. So. And one thing I will say about AA is, you know, the belief is, or with the steps, you don't have to believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
It is about accepting a higher power, any higher power, something other than yourself. So when I talked about how I couldn't get sober myself, you know, that was crucial for me. Like, it could be the group, it could be, you know, but it's about getting out of yourself. But yes, absolutely, there can be, and particularly in the Deep South, you know, the God thing, it can be an issue. So it is important. I agree with you as far as like saying there are many, many paths, you know, for folks who, you know, who want to explore in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And now I wish I knew what that thing was with the wolf. I'm going to be Googling, like,
I really don't remember. It was specifically for men. Yes. And that's another thing is people seem to think that there's not as many resources for, there are.
Yeah.
There are. It's just, sometimes I will say it does take a little bit of a hunt.
Yeah.
And so being curious, I actually really like that idea. You're the first person that I've heard use that, by the way. And
oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm actually curious. Really happy you brought it up.
You talked about therapist. I mean, talking with your family physician, if you have one, talking with, you know, what you find is there are so many, like you said earlier, there are so many resources, but taking that first step.
Tell somebody, ask the question. Ask for help.
Ask for help.
Yeah, it'll usually lead you to, if not a million answers, at least one.
Right.
At least one. And it's starting, right? Like you mentioned, you got to start.
You have to start because, you know, the long-term effects are so significant. And there's nothing, one thing that makes me sad, you know, is seeing somebody who has suffered for decades and hasn't been able to plug into resources for whatever reason. But I also want to say, like, it's never too early, it's never too late.
Yes.
Like, if you come to it and that little spark is in you, like,
trust
tell
it.
Someone
trust it, go with it. Kind of along those lines, I'm also aware that there are a lot of like misconceptions about addiction, substance use disorder. Was there ever a moment in your journey where you received like some unhelpful information that you would hope like nobody else would be telling other people? Because, you know, along the way, somebody might take that step and ask for help. And sometimes maybe somebody says the wrong thing, gives the wrong advice, gives misleading information, and that's not helpful either. So was there a moment for you where that happened?
Oh, yeah. Lots of them. I think the tough thing is when I was brand new and coming in, I just thought everybody had, I was so wide-eyed in a way. Like, wow, you didn't have to drink alcohol for like a day and you're here. Like, I would just take any information. And one thing that does concern me is, you know, there are people who prey on vulnerable individuals who are trying to break the cycle of addiction. So I will say, I would caution people, you know, when they're reaching out for help, there's so many different ways, so many different paths. But for instance, if they're reaching out to a therapist, to reach out to a licensed therapist, to reach out to groups that have a track record, and I kind of like toe the line. It can be sort of tough because, again, there's not a monopoly on it.
Of course, yeah.
But what has concerned me since coming in, you know, I paid a lot of money for programs from recovery coaches who didn't have really any solid underpinning. I'll just say that.
Yeah.
But, you know, did I gain a little bit from that? Sure.
Right.
What I get leery of are people who, you know, are 6 months sober and take an online course and become, you know, quote unquote, certified recovery coaches. Now, I think there's a place for coaching. I think coaching is excellent. And there are excellent programs. But I would just say to really tread carefully.
Do your homework. Check credentials.
Check credentials. And again, for me, what works is working with a licensed mental health professional.
Mm-hmm.
With a medical team. I disclose to all my providers what's going on with me.
Yeah.
And to be engaged with 12-step fellowship and other things. That's what has worked for me.
Yeah.
And that's also part of why I went back to school to mm-hmm. become, you know, I wanted to go really, really deep.
Yeah.
When I started thinking about working in mental health, I wanted to make sure that I had a super solid foundation. And that I was under supervision of people. And again, it's kind of a tangent, but it's important because, again, when I first got sober, I was just looking for any kind of help.
Yeah.
And there are folks, unfortunately, who prey off of that.
Yeah. And first of all, I praise you for going to school and becoming a master at, you know, all the topics before just, you know, going about and telling everybody what's right and what's wrong, because that's obviously something that people do. I always like to say, just because somebody I'm an athlete, so I'm going to talk about sports just for like 5 seconds, but just because somebody was a really good basketball player doesn't make them a really good basketball coach, right? So somebody, if they are like, oh yeah, I struggled with alcoholism too, that doesn't mean they're going to have the answers that you need in order to start your journey. So that's like really important for people to know. Can you find value in sharing those stories and maybe to talking to other people who aren't credentialed or who don't mm-hmm. have that professional mm-hmm. license? Yes, of course. Like you said, you still receive some sort of something sometimes from those bits of information, but it shouldn't stop there either. You should continue to be curious and find those answers.
Absolutely. And I will say to you, I always have to acknowledge my privilege. And the fact is, you know, I am a middle-class white woman,
mm-hmm.
And not everybody has the privilege that I have. So, you know, that's why I am a really big believer in 12-step fellowships, because they accept everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and there are, you know, and obviously there are resources at, you know, local and state level for people who need help, but I have to acknowledge that because privilege does play a role in my story.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think over time I've come to learn, but again, when I was so new and shaky,
mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't really know the difference between the input I'd get from a therapist and the input I'd get from Jane Smith at
mm-hmm.
an AA meeting. I didn't really know.
Yeah.
And I think just being mindful, like everybody's working out their own stuff. Somebody doesn't become a, you know, you never graduate from this. You never graduate like... So just taking everything with like a little bit of grain of salt,
mm-hmm.
You know, particularly if you're early on.
Yeah. Yeah. I did want to look at it from the other side. I had a question for you. So if I am a loved one, family member, and I'm trying to get my person who's struggling with substance use, if I'm trying to get them to get some help, what do I do? Is there something I can say? What's the best thing? Because that can also be a difficult position to be in. On the other side of it, knowing somebody needs help, but not really knowing how to go about it.
Yeah. You may have heard me sigh because it's just, I really connect and empathize with family members mm-hmm. who are in that position.
Yeah.
And it can be a very helpless position.
Yes.
I think first and foremost, becoming educated about the disease of addiction, and learning a little bit more even before speaking with your loved one. There are many, many people who have gone through this very thing, and I'm a big believer in the 12-step fellowship for family members, Al-Anon. And
I'm glad you said it in English, because I was definitely going to say it in Spanish, because that's the way I learned about it.
What is it in Spanish?
Al-Anon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's like very similar, but yeah, I definitely would have gone that route. So I'm glad you said it in English.
And now I've learned something. So I would say, you know, go into one of those meetings. And again, like what's so beautiful now with recovery in 2024 is like, you know, you can pop on, you could just Google Al-Anon meetings, Zoom, virtual Zoom. If they have an open meeting, you can go to one and hear what are people talking about. And they're going to be talking about what you just ask, as far as like, oh, I have this loved one and I'm so scared. Mm-hmm. you know, that that is a wonderful resource to just start understanding a little bit more about this disease, and about how to talk with your loved one. But I mean, the biggest takeaway I would say is, you know, if you're in that position, to take care of yourself, you know, and to we can only change others' behaviors. We can't change others' behaviors. There's a spoiler.
Okay.
So somebody coming to me and saying, you know, my husband's saying, Aaron, you need to stop drinking. I'm so frustrated. Like, that's right. Not why I stop.
Right.
So for the family member, I think the start of this journey is talk with other people who've been through it. And starting to take care of yourself, and learn how to take care of yourself first, is the most important thing.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Does that resonate?
It does. It does make sense. The educational piece I love. Before you have a conversation, attempt to understand what's going on first. I like that a lot. I'm a huge believer in education is powerful. Knowledge is power. And so the more prepared you are going into that conversation or attempting to be there for that person, I would imagine that it would probably go a little bit more successfully. But then also reminding yourself along the way that this is their journey. You know, you may be alongside them as they do it. You can be there for them, but at the end of the day, that they're going to have to do the dirty work.
That's right.
As much as you're going to want to step in and fix, right? Because a lot of us want to be fixers. As much as you're going to want to step in and fix, there does come a time where it does become their independent journey to an extent.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, getting support for your own, if you have a loved one.
Yeah.
Is just crucial. It's a lot of work around boundaries.
Yeah.
You know, where does this person end and where do I start? And that's very complicated. What, you know, when it's somebody you love about, maybe you love.
Yeah.
Maybe you're married to, maybe you're a child, maybe you're, you know, and you're experiencing the consequences.
Yeah.
Which is why getting help for yourself first is so important.
And it comes back to the idea, like, you can't ever take care of somebody else successfully if you don't take care of yourself first. Same thing with loving somebody. You can't love somebody fully until you love yourself first too. So kind of approaching it with that same mindset.
Absolutely. So,
yeah, I like that. I wanted to end on a positive note with you. You have been sober for 8 years. Do we got some months in there too? Is it 8 years exactly?
Probably. Let's see.
This is important.
I guess, but yeah, 8 years and 5 months.
So you're about eight and a half almost.
I had to do the math there.
I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
Congratulations. Now, what's the secret? How do you maintain that today?
Everything that I have, being able to sit across from you, being able to send my child to college, completing my counseling degree, being a caregiver to senior parents, being able to connect with my clients, being able to show up as a human in this, just whatever this world is in 2024.
Tough. We'll go with tough.
Is because of recovery.
Yeah.
Everything I have is because of recovery. And as cliche as it is, I do believe in one day at a time.
Yeah.
I do believe in taking it bit by bit.
Yeah.
You know, I am sober today because other people showed me how to get sober, showed me how to stay sober one day at a time, showed me how to show up for life. Like, life has not all been rainbows and, you know, kittens. Sobriety doesn't promise that. But like,
how I mean, life doesn't promise that.
Life doesn't, right? No, exactly. It's nowhere. So like, but to show up, period.
Yeah.
you know, in small increments. We also say next right thing, just doing the next right thing. You know, but I think I'm sober today. Well, I know it's because of God, but God, how God shows up in people, people who show up to share an encouraging word. You know, people who gave me a second and third chance, old friends and new friends, and like, and hope. And I get to now do the same for other people. So, yeah, I do believe it's a higher power that keeps me sober, but I have to show up and do the action. You know, so it's just a really good, it's a really good way to live. Like, I do believe we are lucky. Like, people in recovery are lucky. That's a really long answer. But it's,
you're okay.
It's not about, like, it's not about just getting sober. It's getting sober and staying sober. And I'm very well aware there are people who have 15 or 20 years, 25 years, and they relapse, you know, and they die. And I don't want to. I really like being here. You know, for whatever, you know, whatever this journey has in store. But like, I want all of it. Alcohol numbs and takes away experiences. I want to show up for all of it.
So it's almost the idea of you waking up every day, reminding yourself of that, and then deciding that today that's not going to happen.
It's not an option. The real challenge today is, will I show up as an emotionally sober woman? I know I'm not going to drink today. Well, will I show up and be nice to the person in traffic? Will I not make a quick reaction to something? And that's the real thing that is sometimes 1 hour at a time, 1 minute at a time. But also having a very healthy respect for this disease. I will say, I have seen end stage alcoholism. I've seen it up close and personal, particularly in the past year. And, it is so real and so serious, and I have to have a very healthy respect, for that. And I do. And I have a healthy respect also for the joy that's come into my life, because even though I talk about very serious things, I am very serious. Like, being in recovery also helps me laugh. Helps me have fun. We talked about ending on a positive note, and I will say, like, I laugh now and am silly and creative in a way that I never was. When I was under the influence. So, like, have I mentioned it's a good way to live? It is.
Well, thank you. Thank you again for sharing your story, being brave enough to talk about the details too, not just the surface level that I feel like a lot of times we hear out there. For anybody listening, you're not alone in this fight. There are many, many people, like we talked about today, who experience this, whether it's on their own personal journey towards trying to recover from substance use disorder, or from watching a loved one experience that as well. So thank you for your time, Erin. And to all of my people listening, thank you for spending some time with me today as we entangled ourselves in the mental world of substance use disorder and addiction. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to share and subscribe, and catch yet another episode next Friday. As always, our goal is to spread awareness on the importance of mental health as it relates to every person. No matter who you are or what you do, there's not a single person that goes unaffected by mental health. So don't forget, you are mentally entangled in every aspect of your life. See you next time.